From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Supreme Court nominee John Roberts' association with the Federalist Society is extremely important because with 15 practice groups mapping out every area of American jurisprudence, the right-wing Federalist Society represents a major threat to the commonly accepted democratic jurisprudence of our nation.
Supreme Court nominee John Roberts and the Federalist Society will speak with Alfred Ross of the Institute for Democracy Studies. Then, as two of the country's largest unions leave the AFL-CIO, we'll talk with a labor journalist about what he calls an unholy alliance, the AFL-CIO and the National Endowment for Democracy in Venezuela. But first, we'll speak with the head of Telesur, a new Latin American satellite TV channel, and go to Egypt for a report on the latest in the Sharm el-Sheikh bombings. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Two of the largest unions in the AFL-CIO have officially left the Labor Federation to protest the state of the nation's labor movement. The Teamsters and the Service Employees International Union represent about one quarter of the AFL-CIO's membership. Two more unions, United Food and Commercial Workers and Unite Here, are also on the verge of leaving. The split marks one of the biggest rifts ever in the American labor movement. We'll have more on this later in the program. A new government study has found the total cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan will top $700 billion over the next decade. Already $300 billion has been spent. The total cost estimate comes from the Congressional Budget Office. The San Francisco Chronicle reports this would make the combined campaigns the most expensive military effort in the last 60 years. It's estimated the Vietnam War cost about $600 billion in current dollars. The Korean War cost about $430 billion in current dollars. Another government study on Iraq is also making news this week. A joint report by the Pentagon and State Department has concluded the Iraqi police force has been infiltrated by the Iraqi resistance. The report also criticizes the U.S. military for failing to adequately train the local police forces. Here in this country, a U.S. soldier has been sentenced to 18 months in prison after he pleaded guilty to shooting dead an Iraqi police officer. Corporal Dustin Berg pleaded guilty on the day his military court-martial was set to begin. Berg was also accused of shooting himself in order to help bolster his claim he shot the Iraqi in self-defense. Meanwhile, a new poll by the Pew Research Center has found 64% of Americans believe President Bush does not have a clear strategy for bringing the situation in Iraq to a successful conclusion. In Britain, police have identified two men as being suspects in last week's attempted bombings in London. The police did not give the nationality of the men, but there's been wide speculation in the British press that some of them are from East Africa, possibly Somalia. One of the world's largest record companies, Sony BMG, has agreed to pay a $10 million settlement in a major payola case. New York's Attorney General Elliot Spitzer sued the company for illegally paying radio stations thousands of dollars to play certain artists, including Jennifer Lopez and Franz Ferdinand. Spitzer said, quote, "Contrary to listener expectations that songs are selected for airplay based on artistic merit and popularity, airtime is often determined by undisclosed payoffs to radio stations and their employees." Spitzer also criticized the radio stations for accepting the payment. He said the Federal Communications Commission should consider stripping the licenses of the stations. On Monday, FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein called for an immediate federal investigation of payola practices. This news from Zimbabwe. The United Nations is estimating 700,000 people have been left without homes or their livelihood following the government's effort to destroy slum areas. The UN estimates another 2.4 million people have been affected by the campaign. The report called the program a, quote, disastrous venture that was being carried out, quote, with indifference to human suffering. The Zimbabwe government has defended its moves as a needed cleanup of the nation's slums, but critics say the program is politically motivated. Most of the homes destroyed belong to opponents of Robert Mugabe's government. On Monday, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said he'd accepted an invitation from Mugabe to travel to Zimbabwe to witness firsthand what's happening. The New York Times is reporting the Pentagon has quietly joined forces with the Filipino military to hunt down a leader of the Islamic group Abu Sayyaf inside the Philippines. A military official told the paper that Navy SEALs and Army Special Forces are now working in the Philippines and that the U.S. is providing intelligence and communication support. In political news, members of the Democratic Leadership Council are calling on the Democratic Party to get tougher on defense spending by military, by 100,000 troops, and for allowing military recruiters to have unrestricted access to college campuses. The DLC held a two-day meeting in Columbus, Ohio, where it outlined a new agenda for the party based on national security, family values, health care, tax reform, and managing the federal government. The founder of the DLC, Al Fromm, called on the party to reach out to more political moderates. He said, quote, "We have to win about 60% of the moderates to break even. There has never been a time when there were more liberals than conservatives in the electorate." Fromm said, quote, "We've got to make it clear that Michael Moore doesn't speak for us." On Monday, Senator Hillary Clinton agreed to chair a new effort by the DLC called the American Dream Initiative to help shape a new agenda for the country and Democratic Party. In Italy, federal court has issued arrest warrants for six more CIA agents in connection with the kidnapping of an Egyptian cleric from the streets of Milan. A total of 19 CIA operatives are now wanted in the case. The cleric was allegedly snatched on a Milan street in February 2003, flown to an airbase in Germany, then to Egypt, where he was reportedly tortured. The operation was allegedly part of the CIA's extraordinary rendition program, in which people are transferred to third countries without court approval, subjecting them to possible torture. In India, dozens of workers and police officers have been injured following protests at a Honda plant in the city of Gurgaon. The protests began after the plant fired or suspended 54 workers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we move now to our first feature. Ever since President Bush announced in primetime that his nominee to the Supreme Court would be John Roberts, momentum has been building for a showdown at Roberts' confirmation hearing scheduled for September. At this point, it seems unlikely that Roberts is in any great risk of not being confirmed, but Democrats have made clear they intend to ask him to publicly state his views on some of the most politically divisive issues on Capitol Hill, most prominent among them, a woman's right to choose. The White House has painted Roberts as a candidate made for the Supreme Court, and his resume has gained praise from both sides of the aisle. But John Roberts has left a rather short paper trail. What we do know is drawn largely from his career as a lawyer, where he's defended Operation Rescue, has made the argument that Roe v. Wade has no constitutional basis. We know he advised Florida Governor Jeb Bush during the 2000 election showdown, and that as a Bush-appointed judge, he sat on a three-judge panel that a week and a half ago handed the Bush administration a key victory by allowing military trials to go ahead at Guantanamo instead of giving prisoners access to the rights guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution. We also know that he's described as a solid conservative who worked for President Bush's father as well as Ronald Reagan. We also know the Bush administration lobbied conservative groups to support Roberts for a year leading up to his nomination. As the TV ad war continues, the Roberts story has taken a new twist. There's growing focus today on an organization that Roberts claims he can't remember whether he joined, the Federalist Society. Roberts and the White House say the nominee has no recollection about his possible membership. But yesterday, the Washington Post reported it obtained a 1997-98 Federalist Society leadership directory listing John Roberts, then a partner in a private law firm, as being a steering committee member in the group's Washington chapter. On Monday, Roberts declined to say why he was listed in the directory when asked by a reporter about the discrepancy during a morning Get Acquainted meeting with Senator Dianne Feinstein. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan was asked about Roberts and the Federalist Society at the daily press briefing.
It was reported, as you know, that he was in the Federalist Society, which is an important legal group and conservative on the conservative side. Then the White House said, no, it was not the case, and now it appears that he was part of the leadership group. What is the real story here?
Now, he has no memory of ever joining or paying dues to the Federalist Society. He has no recollection of that. He has participated in events and panel discussions. He's given speeches at Federalist Society forums, but he doesn't have any recollection of ever paying dues or joining the organization.
Isn't that kind of a simple thing to nail down?
Well, David, he's answered this over the last few years. The issue has come up, and he certainly has participated in some of the events that they've sponsored or that they've hosted, but he just doesn't have any memory of ever paying any dues to the organization.
White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan being questioned Monday at the White House. Meanwhile, another man with close ties to the Federal Society, Timothy Flanagan, is on Capitol Hill today, where his confirmation hearings begin in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's been nominated as Deputy Attorney General. We're joined now in Washington, D.C., by the man who uncovered John Roberts' membership in the Federalist Society, Alfred Ross, as founder and president of the Institute for Democracy Studies. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us about what you know, what evidence you have that John Roberts is a member of the Federalist Society, and then, of course, what the Federalist Society is?
Well, Roberts, whether he's paid his dues or not, was prominently listed in the 1997-1998 leadership directory published by the Federalist Society itself. So it's very difficult to believe that he didn't have any membership. He was on the steering committee. The important question is not whether he paid dues as a member or not. The question really at stake here is where does Roberts and his Federalist Society cronies plan to steer our ship of state? If one looks at the history of the Federalist Society, which was established at the inspiration of Robert Bork in the early 80s, their entire trajectory has been to move our judicial system in an extremely radically right-wing direction. In order to effectuate this, the Federalist Society has established 15 practice groups, which you can find on their own website, which is fed-soc.org. These 15 practice groups are busy developing new legal theories for every area of American jurisprudence, from civil rights law to national security law, international law, securities regulations law, and so on. And if one goes through the publications of their practice groups, one can only gasp not only at the breadth of their agenda, but the extremism of their ideology. It's not insignificant that today Timothy Flanagan will have hearings at the Senate Judiciary Committee on his nomination to be Deputy Attorney General of the United States. In the same leadership directory that lists John Roberts on the steering committee of the Federalist Society, it lists Timothy Flanagan on the program committee of the Federalist Society. And both men have their own personal track records in the right wing of American jurisprudence.
Al Ross, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I was just going to say, in 1987, the Senate Judiciary decided that Robert Bork's ideology was so far outside the mainstream of American jurisprudence that he was not fit to serve on the Supreme Court. The same kind of strict scrutiny should be applied to John Roberts, who is on the steering committee of the organization that Robert Bork inspired.
So the Federalist Society founded under the first term of Ronald Reagan?
Yes, it was established in early 1980s. On their website, they claim 1982.
And how did you get a hold of the documents? Here you have the Washington Post first doing a piece saying that John Roberts was a member of the Federalist Society. Then they retracted that. And now yesterday, another piece saying that they were wrong, that in fact they were right the first time that he was a member.
Well, we were able to obtain the document, which is not particularly secret, although it was their own internal leadership directory. I mean, it has a very glossy cover and must have had hundreds, if not thousands, of copies made and distributed all across the country. My recollection is that someone handed it to me at one of their meetings, which anyone can go to. The question is not the document itself. The issue is, why did the White House issue this unprecedented series of calls to the national media to try to cover up his membership? And the answer to that question is that the White House does not want the Senate Judiciary Committee or the American people to understand the full agenda of the Federalist Society. Timothy Flanagan was one of the people who signed on to the Supreme Court brief in 2000 in Bush v. Gore to try to get this born-again Christian, George Bush, into the White House. The goal was not just to get Bush into the White House. The goal was to use the Bush administration to implement the wide-ranging agenda of the Federalist Society. And it wasn't coincidental that along with Flanagan on the cover of the brief was the name of Ted Olson, chair of the Federalist Society in D.C., who then became Solicitor General of the United States and argued strenuously against affirmative action and other programs while he was Solicitor General.
Timothy Flanagan, the man who's before the Senate Judiciary Committee today, nominated as Deputy Attorney General of the United States.
Yes, I think it's important for the Senate Judiciary Committee to inquire into the jurisprudence of the practice groups of the Federalist Society. But their agenda goes beyond just the substantive law of the different practice groups. As the right-wing legal groups begin to push their theories of devolution, basically states' rights, moving more of American law into the states, the Federalist Society recently launched a state judicial selection project so they could move not only their judges into the federal courts, but also into the state courts. If they accomplish their agenda of dominating the federal and state courts, they will have an effective stranglehold on the American legal system. The man who was chosen to head the Federalist Society State Judicial Selection Project is a chap named Clint Bolick, who wrote a book called The Affirmative Action Fraud and edited another book called Unfinished Business, A Civil Rights Strategy for the Next Century. Again, it's not coincidental that the introduction to Unfinished Business was by Charles Murray, who wrote The Bell Curve, arguing basically that African Americans had a lower IQ than white people and therefore were basically forever limited in how far they should get, making affirmative action programs useless.
We're talking to Al Ross, head of the Institute for Democratic Studies, who got a hold of the document that said that John Roberts, the Supreme Court nominee, was on the in the directory of the Federalist Society in 1997-98. Now, John Roberts claims he cannot remember if he joined or not. Your response to that, Al Ross?
Well, we can't yet do an MRI scan of his brain to see whether there's a memory cell there or not. But it would be very difficult indeed for him to deny his association with the organization. I mean, how does he get to be listed as a member of the steering committee? And I suppose the Senate Judiciary Committee can inquire and ask for whatever correspondence existed. But again, the important point here is not this memory lapse, which is strange given his reputation as having one of the more spectacular memories in the legal community in Washington, D.C. But again, the growth of this organization within the Bush administration and the implementation of its views. The Inspector General of the Department of Defense had been also with Roberts on the steering committee of the Federalist Society. And Paul Clement, the current Solicitor General of the United States, chaired the litigation practice group of the Federalist Society. Alex Acosta, another Federalist Society member, and leader, was recently deployed to be the U.S. attorney in the critical state of Florida, having served as Assistant Attorney General of the United States for Civil Rights. So Roberts can deny it, and people can decide whether or not to believe him, but it'd be hard for him to deny his association with the group of lawyers furthering the agenda of the Federalist Society. Before the election of 2000, we actually published a brief on the Federalist Society, which people can obtain by contacting our office, the Institute for Democracy Studies in New York. But the agenda's there. It's on their website. It's clear that Roberts was on the steering committee. Whether his partners at Hogan and Hartson realized that he was there feeding information to the Federalist Society and presumably trying to recruit and helping develop their agenda.
Al Ross, why the title Federalist Society? Why the name?
Well, it's interesting. At one of their recent conferences at Yale Law School, which was open to anyone who wanted to attend, they actually chuckled about the fact that originally they were going to name it the Anti-Federalist Society, but it didn't sound very good, so they called it the Federalist Society. And the point here is this organization of extremist lawyers really has no principles about what they call themselves, whether they remember if they were members of the steering committee or not. The point is, whatever sells and moves their agenda forward, they're prepared to use. And this debate over Federalist or the Anti-Federalist is really illustrative of the underlying cynicism and ruthlessness of this organization.
Are you saying that the White House called the Washington Post to get them to retract that Roberts was a member of the Federalist Society, which then they did, and now with the documents they are reasserting that he was?
Well, that's clear. They not only called the Washington Post, but they called a number of other prominent newspapers across the country. And the reason why they were doing it is they very much did not want the Senate Judiciary Committee or the American people to unravel the thread of the Federalist Society and begin to discover the incredible penetration of its membership throughout our judicial system, and more importantly, the underlying ideology that the group represents. Roberts himself has only sat on a federal court for basically about 2 years, which is amazing for someone to be appointed to the Supreme Court. And the question is, how does one begin to access his underlying ideology? And this is a very important way for the Senate Judiciary and the American people to understand Roberts, Flanagan, and the Bush administration's goals for our legal system.
Al Ross, while you may not agree with the Federalist Society, apparently there are tens of thousands of members. Why doesn't, with conservatives in the ascendancy and the government, why don't they just say, sure, and he represents our ideology? What's wrong with that?
Well, it's interesting. A number of conservatives actually were upset with the White House for trying to cover up the connection because they're quite proud of it. But I think the issue here is I believe, correct awareness by the Bush administration's spin masters that the majority of the American people would not support the ideology of the Federalist Society, even though, admittedly, thousands of right-wing lawyers are very glad to further their agenda.
Finally, do they take a stance on abortion?
Well, officially, the Federalist Society as an organization doesn't take a stance on anything, but that's rather a sham. Throughout their literature and at their forums, they endorse not only anti-abortion ideology, but extremist ideology on civil rights, national security law, telecommunications law, and every other issue you can possibly imagine.
Alfred Ross, we want to thank you very much for being with us, founder and president of the Institute for Democracy Studies based in New York. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Amy.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Egyptian government has dismissed speculation that a group of Pakistani men were involved in Saturday's triple bombing in the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. Egyptian police are searching for six missing Pakistanis, but the Egyptian ambassador to Pakistan called it a, quote, routine security check. Police in Sharm el-Sheikh have distributed the photographs and passport numbers of the six men who disappeared from a Cairo hotel earlier this month. The official death toll in the bombing stands at 64, but hospital officials say the figure could be as high as 88. Most of the casualties were Egyptian. As many as 17 foreigners were killed, most of them European. One American was among the dead. The attacks, which rocked the resort town on the tip of the Sinai Peninsula, appeared well-coordinated. Two massive car bombs went off simultaneously at 1:15 a.m., about 2 miles apart. One car, packed with explosives, slammed into the reception of the Ghazala Gardens in Nama Bay, where the main strip of hotels are located. The second bomb exploded in a nearby area called the Old Market, frequented mainly by Egyptians working in the town's resorts. A third bomb detonated about the same time near a beachside walkway. Egyptian officials told the New York Times they now believe all three explosions were suicide bombings. More than 1,000 people marched through Sharm el-Sheikh's main road on Sunday to protest the attacks. At least five groups have claimed responsibility for the bombings. None of them have been verified. On Monday, Egyptian police fought gun battles in desert mountains near Sharm el-Sheikh in a hunt for Bedouins who authorities say may have links with the bombings. 25 people have reportedly been arrested. The Associated Press has reported the heads of security in North and South Sinai provinces have been sacked after having failed to anticipate or prevent the bombings. Sharm el-Sheikh is one of Egypt's most heavily guarded towns. It's the winter home of President Hosni Mubarak, hosts numerous summits, and is the destination for about a quarter of the tourists who visit Egypt. An attack on Taba, 125 miles north of Sharm el-Sheikh on the Israeli border last October, ended a long halt in Egyptian militant violence. The last major attack had been in 1997, when Islamic militants killed 58 tourists and four Egyptians in Luxor. We go now to Sharm el-Sheikh to speak with Jonathan Steele, the senior foreign correspondent for The Guardian of London. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jonathan.
Good to be with you.
It's good to be with you. Can you talk about the latest?
Well, the latest is, as you said, that the Pakistani connection seems increasingly tenuous. A number of senior officials, including the Egyptian ambassador in Pakistan and the assistant interior ministry, a spokesperson has said that Pakistan is not being sought in connection with the bombings. It's some security check. There are other people being sought, but they're not connected with these bombings. And so we're left really where we are pretty much when this bomb happened, that the police still don't know really which lead to follow. As you say, there are five different groups have made claims. There's no evidence that any of them could be serious. They may or may not be, but there's nothing to point to it other than just purely the web statements. And I think most people now assume that the link is more with the Taba bombings last October, which appears to have been done by local Egyptian militants of one kind. It's not quite sure exactly what their purpose was, although obviously Taba is very close to Israel, so it would be connected with the Egyptian-Israeli issue. Egypt, after all, is the country that is most closely connected in the Arab world with Israel. It still has diplomatic relations. And people therefore think it's not to do with al-Qaeda, it's not to do with Osama bin Laden, it's much more to do with Egyptian militants.
Jonathan Steele, after the Taba bombings, there was a massive roundup of people, I think something like 2,500 Bedouins. Human Rights Watch put out a report talking about torture and the problems with this roundup. What do you know about this?
Well, yes, I think the figure is actually a little bit higher than that. The Egyptian Organization for Human Rights, which is an independent watchdog body, talked about 3,000 people being arrested, of whom 200 are still being held. Some of the wives and family of those people recently held a street demonstration to protest that. And in fact, almost by coincidence, just on Sunday, the second stage of a trial of two people who were rounded up in that big sweep was going on in the city of Ismailia near the Suez Canal. Now, observers, independent observers who are monitoring that trial are saying not only that the people are protesting their innocence, but that they claimed that they had been tortured. When the trial opened in early July, the defendants showed injuries to journalists that they say they had sustained under torture, and the judge actually did then order medical tests to be taken to see exactly when these injuries were sustained. But at the court session this Sunday, just the other day, the court was told that the government authorities hadn't yet issued the correct medical papers to allow doctors to examine these defendants, who again on Sunday claimed that they'd been tortured. The claims obviously need to be verified, but there is a general amount of evidence that torture is, if not routine, quite frequent in Egyptian police stations and prisons, and therefore these claims may well be credible. Certainly the families of the of these people are saying that they were just rounded up at home, that they had no political backgrounds, no criminal records, and that they are really, in other words, just the fall guys or the scapegoats for a system which wants to show that something is being done, but that is perhaps floundering and really getting to the bottom of it.
Jonathan Steele, about the significance of Sharm el-Sheikh being the second home of the Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak?
I think that's very important. And the other very important point is that these bombings happened on July the 23rd, which is a very important national day here. It is the 53rd anniversary of the 1952 revolution, which overthrew the monarchy. And brought in the army officers regime, which was then led by Gamal Abdel Nasser. So that is a very important symbolic day, plus the fact that Mubarak has a residence here, also because he's tried to turn this into a big showcase city, not just for tourism, but for international conferences. Many Arab and international summits have been held here, including with President Bill Clinton and so on. So just strike at the heart of this city, which is much better guarded, I must say, than most Egyptian cities, was a deliberate coup, I think, by the people who planned this bombing.
And is it true that Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, your Prime Minister, also has a home in Sharm el-Sheikh?
No, he doesn't have a home here, but he has twice spent the New Year's holidays here in a private villa with his family. So he certainly likes this place, and a great deal of British tourists come here. So there were apparently 9,000 altogether at the time of the bombing on Saturday. Many of them have left, but not all, and there's still quite a number here. But I think the most tragic thing at the moment now is the search for the missing. Out of the 17 foreigners killed, it seems that as many as 11 may be British, and families are now coming out here with photographs, desperately walking around the cafes and restaurants, asking people whether they could have seen their sons or their children or parents, in one case, a grandmother and a mother. The children are looking for them. So it is a very desperate scene because this really was a very popular place, particularly among British tourists.
Jonathan Steele, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Jonathan Steele of The Guardian in London, speaking to us from Sharm el-Sheikh. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM stations, public access TV and PBS stations, as well as both TV satellite networks on Dish Network Channel 9415, 9410, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. We're podcasting and video and audio streaming at democracynow.org, and our headlines are in Spanish and transcript, as well as audio, You can get transcripts of all of the broadcast at democracynow.org. As we continue with our broadcast today, some are calling it Latin America's Al Jazeera. This weekend, a coalition of leftist governments, media outlets, and movements led by Venezuela officially launched Telesur, a new Latin America-wide satellite TV network. Just after noon Sunday, Telesur began broadcasting a pilot service from the studios in Caracas with a team of 25 journalists and 9 regional bureaus presenting news, quote, from a Latin American perspective. The channel's first news program began with a critical report on the failure of the humanitarian mission in Haiti, followed by a story on the plight of refugees in Colombia. The station's being launched with help from other Latin American governments, including Argentina, Cuba, and Uruguay. The driving force has been Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, whose government has contributed 70% of Telesur's financing and owns 51% of the channel. The channel's board members include a group of international supporters, including the actor Danny Glover, the writer Tarek Ali, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Adolfo Perez Esquivel. But even before its launch, Telesur was being attacked in Washington. Last week, the House passed an amendment calling for the U.S. to begin broadcasting its own channel into the region to counter Telesur. Chavez responded by saying, quote, "We will take measures to neutralize the attempt, and what we will have is a kind of electronic warfare," he said. We go now to Caracas to speak with Eva Golinger, an attorney based in New York, runs the website VenezuelaFoya.info, which has been using the Freedom of Information Act to obtain more information on the connection between the U.S. government and anti-Chavez opposition in Venezuela. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Eva Golinger.
Thank you. Good morning, Amy.
Very good to have you with us. Can you talk about the significance of this new Latin American TV satellite network?
Well, this is a project that the Venezuelan government has been working on for the past 6 years. So it's amazing to finally see it come to fruition. And this effort, basically since the beginning of this year or spring, Telesur has been in motion. There was also a signal was launched in May that was basically just a trial, and it has been broadcast just about an hour a day in different Latin American countries on DirecTV satellite television and on some cable channels. But now officially the pilot channel has been launched. It'll be 4 hours a day of broadcasting, primarily on satellite and cable, and in some countries they've been able to pick up on their local stations a Telesur signal. But basically, I mean, the point of this channel is included in the entire perspective of what's happening here in Venezuela, this Bolivarian revolution, Latin American integration, basically bringing back the voice of Latin America to the people, to being able to project and see themselves in their own eyes. And that's really what the purpose of this station is to counteract the images and the politics and the media manipulation that's coming out of stations like CNN, which is incredible because people in Venezuela and in Brazil and in Argentina and in other South American nations see themselves through the eyes of U.S. bureaus. CNN in Spanish, which is what's broadcast the news of Latin America throughout Latin America, is based in Atlanta, Georgia, and is, of course, run by CNN, which is a U.S. company. And other channels, even in Venezuela, for example, it's primarily private media channels are run. The largest media owner in Venezuela is Gustavo Cisneros and the Cisneros Group of Companies, which also owns the Univision network is one of the largest shareholders of the Univision network in the United States, and is broadcasting also a perspective that primarily is promoting U.S. interests, U.S. commercial interests primarily. And I mean, this has been an ongoing issue in Venezuela of utmost importance, which is why the Telesur is so crucial at this time, because in Venezuela they've been living through for the past 6 years, basically, but primarily since the time of the coup in April 2002, against which briefly overthrew President Chavez, an all-out media war, where all private media in Venezuela are against the government, and not only are against the government, but constantly are projecting images that distort and manipulate information. So Telesur is going to be the attempt to balance out this media war, well, to engage in it in some ways. But
Ava Gollinger, we're also joined on the phone by the Minister of Communication for Venezuela, Ava Gollinger, a lawyer who represents Venezuela, author of the Chavez Code. And we hope we have him with us, Andres Azara, who joins us on the line from Caracas, president of Telesur. Are you with us, Andres Azara? We may have lost him, so we'll try to get him back on the line. But continue with what you were saying, Ava Gollinger.
Well, I'd like to mention the fact that, the book, The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela, which is my book recently published in Venezuela and waiting still to be published in the United States, although I've already signed two contracts with different publishers, and they've both backed out at the last minute. It must be due to government pressure, because the book is about the ongoing U.S. intervention in Venezuela over the past 4 years approximately, since basically 6 months or a year before the time of the coup. And after that, we had in Venezuela, after the April 2002 coup, which was you know, a failed coup in the fact that the people came out and took back their president on April 13th. Later that same year, in December, was a 64-day-long strike led by oil industry executives and other managers in different professions and the media. And what took place was something completely unprecedented. All private media stations gave over their broadcasting time 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to the opposition to the Venezuelan government. And they broadcast nonstop propaganda, basically distorted information and sometimes violent, aggressive images in the attempt to overthrow the government. It was really the first time to see an entire media block join in with a political force to try to overthrow a government. They failed, of course, in that attempt. And now we're seeing that Telesur, before it's even launched, the U.S. government, which already has a monopoly on information, not just in Venezuela, in all of Latin America and also in the United States, in terms of what perspective people should be seeing, what type of public opinion there should be about what's taking place in countries like Venezuela, where there's a model, a political model being implemented that contrasts the U.S. model, the neoliberal capitalist model. And here we're seeing last week the House of Representatives approved an amendment that was promoted by Florida Representative Congressman Connie Mack to authorize, not to fund, but to authorize 30 minutes a day of broadcasting transmissions into Venezuela to counteract the Telesur perspective. I mean, basically saying, oh, no, here's Telesur is going to come out, and what they called it was anti-Americanism, and then the U.S. government then therefore needs to spend our taxpayer dollars to broadcast even more transmissions and images and information into Venezuela.
Ava Gollinger, I'm going to cut you off there because it looks like we have been joined by Andres Azara and ask stations to hold on for the break for a minute so we don't lose him. He is president of Telesur, the national TV Latin American network that was just launched on Sunday, joining us on the line from Caracas. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Andres Azara.
Thank you, Amy. Good morning to you.
Very good to have you with us. Can you talk about the significance of this new network that you have launched?
Well, this is a network that we're launching towards fomenting, pushing integration between the Latin American nations. It has a clear vision in that sense. We're trying to have a network where we can look at our own processes, our own societies, our own culture with our own eyes. Nowadays, you get news and information of what's going on in Argentina or Brazil or Bolivia through the American networks. This is an effort to try to know each other within ourselves with our own eyes. Hello?
Yes. Can you talk about the efforts by the U.S. Congress passing legislation to launch information into Latin America to counter this international Latin American TV satellite network, Telesur?
Well, we see this as an initiative from the extremists. You know, it's a very crazy idea to do this. I mean, first of all, you get all this U.S. networks being broadcast into Venezuela already. The biggest propaganda machine of the Bush administration, Fox News, you get it here 24 hours through the cable channel. So and the own opposition-controlled private networks are aligned with the U.S. messages. So we really don't see a need to, for the money of U.S. taxpayers being used to launch another TV Martí or Radio Martí into Venezuela. Second of all, this is not a network that's going to be broadcasting anti-U.S. people messages. It is a network against imperialism in all of its expression, especially cultural imperialism. So we see this initiative as an effort that's basically going to waste U.S. taxpayers' money. We are not really worried about what this initiative can do to us. We will broadcast our signal, our messages, our newscasts, our movies, our documentaries, independently of what the U.S. tries to do against us.
Andres Azara, you had your own experience in Venezuela as a reporter at the time of the attempted coup against Chavez, who you now work for. Can you talk about what happened and why you quit?
Yeah, that was during the coup in April of 2002. I quit basically because of the censorship that was imposed on the journalists who were working at this station. Because the station was basically trying to, they cut all news of what was going on and how the people reacted to Chavez when he was taken out of power. This huge manifestations and protests happened all over the country, and basically there was an information blackout sponsored by the main TV stations and pretty much the whole media. They were trying to legitimize through the media the new dictatorial regime that was imposed on Venezuela with the help of the United States.
Well, Andres Azara, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Minister of Communication for Venezuela, president of Telesur, the new international Latin American satellite network that has just been launched, as well Eva Gollinger, a lawyer who has represented Venezuela, author of the book The Chavez Code. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. Music by Desorden Público, Venezuelan group. They perform Sunday night at the celebration marking the launch of Telesur. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to a major story that has implications for the future of organized labor in this country and internationally. It's being called one of the largest shakeups in union history. Yesterday, two of the largest unions within the powerful AFL-CIO pulled out, announcing they are pulling out of the federation. The presidents of the team Teamsters and the Service Employees International Union made their announcements as the AFL began its 50th anniversary convention in Chicago. The Service Employees have 1.8 million members. The Teamsters claim 1.5 million. They contribute roughly $20 million each year, about a sixth of the AFL budget. Two other major unions, United Food and Commercial Workers and Unite Here, are boycotting this week's convention, have indicated they too would leave the Federation. At the center of this major split is the future of organized labor. The dissident unions have consistently criticized AFL-CIO President John Sweeney for not investing enough in grassroots organizing campaigns and relying too heavily on lobbying in Washington. Sweeney's backers have accused the dissident unions of playing into the hands of opponents of organized labor. Another major issue for some at the AFL convention in Chicago is the issue of the Federation's alleged involvement in destabilization campaigns in countries like Venezuela. This weekend, activists held a demonstration at the Chicago Pier to protest what they see as AFL's cooperation with Bush administration's hostile foreign policies and covert operations, particularly in Venezuela. We're joined now in Chicago by two guests. Kim Sipes is a labor journalist, professor of sociology at Purdue University. Also, we're joined by Fred Hirsch. He's vice president of the Plumbers Union in San Jose and longtime activist in Latin American Solidarity Coalition. Let's go first to Kim Sipes. Talk about why you held this protest on Sunday.
Okay, we have been examining AFL-CIO foreign policy for a long time, and their foreign policy goes back to the early 1900s with the AFL. They had helped intervene in the Mexican Revolution. They had tried to push the U.S. into World War I, and they played a key role in setting U.S. foreign policy towards the Soviet Revolution in 1917. More recently, they've been involved in overthrowing elected governments, such as Guatemala in 1954, Brazil in 1964, and Chile in 1973. We thought things had changed under John Sweeney, but as we examine the situation, things are going back to the bad old days, and we're protesting that. And there has been a resolution by the California State AFL-CIO that was unanimously passed that condemned the top-level foreign policy leaders for their operations. And we have a resolution at the convention. We are trying to build public support to get this resolution through the Resolutions Committee to keep it from being blocked up and get it to the floor of the convention. That's why we were out there.
We tried to get on the Solidarity Center, the international wing of the AFL, but they didn't want to come on with you, Kim Sipes. We hope to have them on later this week. But the AFL has said that they have taken a new approach to foreign policy, have admitted some of what AFL did in the past. But what about today? What about the AFL today? I mean, I think most people think of the AFL-CIO as much more aligned with Democrats than with the Republican Party and President Bush's foreign policies.
Well, we have to be clear here, Amy. This is not the overall AFL-CIO. What this is a small level of upper echelon leaders such as John Sweeney, such as Bill Lucey, such as Barbara Shaler, such as Harry Cambers, people at the very top that have been carrying out a foreign policy that is behind the backs, although they act in the name of American workers. But they've never cleared the air about what they've done. They've never cleared what their operations are in something like 40 countries around the world today. They have been repeatedly asked by affiliated unions and organizations to clear the air. They refuse. We found that they had been involved in Venezuela, and that we also have found them involved with the Bush Department's Advisory Committee on Labor and Diplomacy, which has been trying to reinvigorate the labor attaché program in U.S. embassies around the world, and that's a key point for attacking unions in these developing countries.
Let me finish. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say, is that it had gotten better under John Sweeney, but as we keep examining, things have gone back, and then their continuing relationship with the National Endowment for Democracy. And so their claims that they've cleaned up, that they've cleared the air, are bogus. They're lying still.
I understand that as part of the amendment that was passed in Congress to respond to the launch of the International Latin American TV Network, Telesur, was something like $9 million to the National Endowment for Democracy. Your response, Kim?
Well, the National Endowment for Democracy is one of the most cynical operations I've ever seen. First of all, they claim it's private and non-governmental, and that's a lie from A to Z. They've been almost totally funded by the U.S. Congress. They were founded under a resolution, legislation passed by the Congress. President Reagan signed it in law in 1983. Basically, what they're trying to do is that they're trying to use our love for democracy, the one person, one vote, everybody who's affected gets to have a say in decisions, going back to the no taxation without representation thing. That's what we call popular or grassroots democracy, and that's how most Americans understand the word democracy. But the National Endowment for Democracy has no idea that. What they are doing is a top-down, elite-driven form of democracy, which is sometimes called polyarchical democracy, which means that people, yes, people get to vote, but their choices are, do they get to vote for Pepsi or do they get to vote for Coke? Can they propose solutions? Yes, they can, as long as they've been presented by the elite. So the National Endowment for Democracy is going around the world instituting this top-down form of democracy and yet calling it, using the terms of the grassroots, popular democracy. Now, combined in the National Endowment for Democracy is the international wing of the Democratic Party, the international wing of the Republican Party, the international wing of the Chamber of Commerce, and the Solidarity Center, which is the international wing of the AFL-CIO.
Kim's
again, done behind the backs of the members of the AFL-CIO.
Kim Sipes, before we get to the end of the program, I want to turn to our second guest, Kim Sipes, a labor journalist and professor of sociology at Purdue University. Fred Hirsch, also in the Chicago studio, vice president of the Plumbers and Pipe Fitters Union in San Jose, longtime activists in the Latin America Solidarity Coalition. You've done particular historical research on the AFL, the National Endowment for Democracy, and Chile. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. I first got involved with this issue in 1973 when we all had great hopes for the success of the democratically elected government and program of Salvador Allende in Chile. And when his government was overthrown in San Jose, California, we put together an organization to defend democracy in Chile. And our labor part of the organization, our labor task force, came up with some research showing how deeply involved the AFL-CIO had been through the American Institute for Free Labor Development and through use of ORIT, the Inter-American Inter-American Workers Organization, part of the ICFTU, and through use of the International Labor Secretariats of the ICFTU, which is the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions. And it became quite evident that the coup in Chile, which cost the lives of well over 3,000 people, most of them trade unionists and militants, progressive people, could not have taken place without the contribution made by the AFL-CIO. And in fact, in the last words of Salvador Allende, just moments before he was killed when the coup, the Pinochet coup took place, he put responsibility for what occurred in Chile that day on the leaders of the professional unions, those very unions which we later saw were receiving funds and resources through AIFLD and its international network.
That AFILD being the international arm of the AFL-CIO years
yes,
ago.
That was the an organization that lasted 33 years. And from its inception, the leaders of the CTV, the Confederation of Workers of Venezuela, were on the executive board of the AIFLD and were working in collaboration then with the top representatives of U.S. industry involved in foreign trade. The Rockefeller interests, the Anaconda Copper, people were on the on that board. And they stayed there in that relationship until today. Not until today, until the demise of the AIFLD in 1997, when John Sweeney reorganized the foreign operations of the AFL-CIO and centralized all activity in the American Center for International Labor Solidarity, the Solidarity Center.
We have 5 seconds. Do you think it's better?
We're moving to do our best.
On that note, I'm going to have to say we'll leave it there and we'll continue the discussion. Fred Hirsch, Vice President of the Plumbers Pipefitters Union in San Jose, as well as Kim Sipes, labor journalist. Thank you so much for joining us. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, from Dukaduce, John Hamilton, and Agara Elizabeth Press, Uber Rich, and Jeremy Scahill. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.